Welcome back to Backbone Radio. I am still Ross Kaminsky and still joined by Rich Sokol and Greg Brophy with Joshua Sharp behind the glass. While we were off the air, Rich, you had some statistics on our debt compared to recent historical debt in the nation. Why don't you tell us what you're looking at and what you think the significance is?
Sure. So we were talking about in 1994 and the contract with America and, you know, how Republicans came in with a bang and then sort of petered out, and were we going to see a repeat of that in 2010? The point I was going to make is that in 1994, in essence, we could afford gridlock, because if you look at what our national debt was then, the debt held by the public was $3.4 trillion. At the time, our GDP was just under $7 trillion, so it was a little under 50%. The debt held by the public was a little under 50% of GDP, and that's the major gauge that we use to look at the health of an economy, is debt to GDP. So in 1994, it was under 50%. You look at where we are today. Today, the debt held by the public is over $9 trillion. We have roughly a $14 trillion GDP. So that's, if I'm doing the math in my head correctly, about 65%. But what's really scary is if you just look at how the government is functioning, the government is basically on autopilot with the entitlement programs. So we are looking at trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye could see. You know, last year was $1.3 trillion. The year before that was $1.4 trillion. This year we're looking at another $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion. I mean, I can't even believe I'm using the word trillion in these numbers. So,
and that debt to GDP number is projected to get to 90% within a few years based on Obama's budgets.
Exactly. Well, if you say we have a $14 trillion economy and we're adding $1.4 trillion of debt every year, we're adding about 10%, 10 points to our debt to GDP ratio every year. So right now, we're at 65. We're adding about 10 points a year. I'll remind our listeners that if you look at Greece, you know, the latest economy to blow up, they blew up when their debt to GDP ratio was about 120%. So we're not there yet. You know, we're at 65%, not 120, but we're adding 10 points a year at just by being on autopilot. So we're going to get there, you know, within the next decade, and our economy will implode just like Greece has imploded if we stay on the track that we're on. So I would argue that gridlock was okay in 94. It's not okay today, because we can't afford to stay on the track we're on.
That's true if the alternative to gridlock is getting good things done, which we don't know yet with this particular president. Many observers, including myself, think that he is a dyed-in-the-wool leftist, not likely to move to the center in the way that Bill Clinton did. And it might be that gridlock is our best possible outcome while this guy is president, although I agree with your point that gridlock in our current circumstances is not good for the nation, because a lot of this stuff in place will just keep growing the debt. But I want to come back to a point you made before the break, which is that citizens are now talking about the debt, which is something we've never seen before. And also to sort of put that together with the point that we were talking about with what do we expect of the Republican Party? Will they do things as Greg said, will they do what they said they were going to do for the first 100 days or some number of months and then sort of drift away for whatever reason? So the question I want to ask both of you guys is, now that people are talking about the debt, now that we have the Tea Party movement and sort of related 9/12 groups and that sort of thing, is there a reason to be more optimistic about the future of this nation politically, and is there a reason to be more optimistic that Republicans believe that people are watching, and that Republicans believe that if they don't do what we elected them to do, that we will get them challenged in Republican primaries and get them booted? Greg, let's start with you.
I think the answer to that is yes, and Rich brought up Greece. And think about the difference between Greece and America. In Greece, when their government was broke, they were out protesting in the streets and tearing things up because they didn't want to have their pensions cut or their retirement age changed. Same thing in France. But in America, millions of people join in Tea Party protests because government is getting too big and doing too much. Just the exact opposite of what goes on in Greece and in France and across, frankly, the most of the rest of the world. And I think that is unique to America, which means I believe that the Tea Party will stay engaged until we solve this conundrum one way or the other. And you're right, we can't continue on with business as usual at the federal government level. And guess what, fellas? We can't even continue on with business as usual at the state government level. California's going to be the first. They'll be the canary in the coal mine. They are effectively bankrupt now. They won't be able to pay their bills. And as the dentist said, the caller who ran against, or the guest who ran against Nancy Pelosi. You can't repeal the law of supply and demand and the basic laws of economics. You can't do that, and that's the difference here. And I think that's why the Tea Party is going to stay engaged, one way or the other. You know, it may morph, it may become less organized, it may become more organized, maybe a little bit of both. But with the power of the Tea Party, and the other thing that America has that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world is talk radio. Talk radio and guys like Glenn Beck on TV with their charts showing what a mess that we are in, and informing people and educating people so then go out and talk to their neighbors about the problems that we have here. This is a unique country. Well, and the whole, by the way, the rest of the world, the balance of the rest of the world, you know, rests on whether or not we solve this problem, because if not, the whole world probably falls into chaos.
Rich, what's your take on citizen involvement, ongoing Tea Party impact, ongoing, and Republican behavior?
Well, I think the Tea Party's for real. They're here to stay, and they're going to make a difference. And I know that because just as a little anecdote, I was talking to my neighbor, and given that it's the holiday season, Christmas is almost upon us, so my neighbor told me a little line that I thought very much encapsulates the conversation we're having. And he said, you know what Christmas is? Christmas is when kids tell Santa Claus everything they want and their parents pay for it. A deficit is when their parents tell the government everything they want and the kids pay for it. Mm. And that's what we're doing today. You know, we are passing on debt to our kids that benefits us, the adults, and we're making our kids pay for it. And that is just immoral and has to stop. And I'll say one other thing about Greece while we're on the subject. So most people probably know that Greece got bailed out at the end of the day. Greece basically went bankrupt, but the IMF and other organizations came in and bailed Greece out. Well, the United States is roughly 35% of the IMF. So we, in essence, contributed to Greece's bailout, which is great, but we're borrowing money basically to bail out a country that's suffering from having borrowed too much money. So my question is, we were there to bail out Greece. Who's going to be there to bail us out? Well, the answer is nobody. There is going to be nobody left to bail us out. That's why we have to get our fiscal house in order now.
So in a few more minutes we've got in this segment, I want to talk about the impact of the Tea Party in this cycle. I think we probably all agree that it was a double-edged sword. I mean, there were, you know, clearly some downsides. You could talk about Dan Mays, even Ken Buck. There were some upsides, not least Marco Rubio and Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, who knocked off Russ Feingold, something I never thought I would see happen. But just in a broader sense, Greg, what is your take on the net impact of the Tea Party on this cycle, and whether you think they will have more or less impact, and also be more or less, with less downside in the next cycle than they had in addition to their upside this time?
Well, I certainly hope that the longer they stay around, the more sophisticated they become, so that we don't end up with the likes of a Dan Mays again. Because I got to tell you, I don't think Dan Mays would have come out of the Colorado, the Republican Assembly without the force of the Tea Party movement. I don't think that's what gave him necessarily the primary victory, but I don't think he would have been on the ballot if it hadn't been for the Tea Party movement showing up at the state Republican Assembly. Almost 60% of the people, rough guess, were there for the first time ever. Clearly, we'd be looking at a U.S. senator named Charlie Crist, who apparently has no principles and no backbone, if it hadn't been for the Tea Party movement in Florida. So God bless him for helping and getting that right. 60 seats in the U.S. House picked up this cycle, the most, you know, since who knows when, since back in the 50s.
1938.
Yeah, it is awesome that happened, and I think that's in no small part because of the activities of the Tea Party movement. They also gave us Sharon Angle, arguably the only Republican in the state of Nevada who could possibly have lost to Harry Reid. So that didn't really, you know, that was kind of a wash there. We talked a little bit off air about Delaware. Christine O'Donnell beat Mike Castle. Castle probably would have won that Delaware seat. If that had given us the majority control of the U.S. Senate, it might have been worth it. Although, given the Senate's rules, I don't think it would have been. Because even if Mike Castle had given us 60 seats in the U.S. Senate, that guy bailed on Republicans so often, he might as well not even be on the team. I got to tell you, I'd almost rather take the loss with Christine O'Donnell than get the win with a Mike Castle in Delaware. We have enough problems with Snow and Collins. We don't need a third.
It was interesting because when that race first came up, I said on this show, I said, for the first time in my life, I want the Rhino to win, because at that time, I thought that race could be the difference between having the majority and not. And, you know, me, I didn't support John McCain for all the reasons you just described about Mike Castle. I mean, Castle's even worse than McCain. But I actually said at the time that I wanted Castle to win because I thought it could be the difference between having the majority and not. If I knew that for sure we wouldn't have the majority, you know, knowing now what I didn't know then, I agree with you. I would rather rid the party of rhinos, but not by having the Tea Party make itself look so bad by nominating someone who is not just not a serious candidate, in my opinion, but not a serious person. I mean, Christine O'Donnell is a joke, every bit the joke that Dan Mays is, and should never have been on the ballot. But at the end of the day, to me, to answer the question that I asked you, I think that the Tea Party is a huge net positive for the energy that they bring. And a lot of these people, as you said, are people who have never been in politics before. And even just going through one cycle will give them a massive education. And I hope there will be a lot fewer Tea Party mistakes the next time around. And at the end of the day, we need their energy, and I need their focus on liberty. Stay with us through this break. When we come back on Backbone Radio, we'll have a few closing thoughts and comments from the from the crowd here in the studio, so stay right with us. You could have
seen it. Talk radio with a spine. This is Backbone Radio.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky, Rich Sokol, Greg Brophy, Joshua Scharf behind the glass. We've been talking about whether or not we're optimistic about what's coming up in American politics given the result of these elections. I think we are uniformly, relatively optimistic about at least what the House will do at the national level. But I want to get back a little bit to state politics. Greg, you know, what is your sense given the balance of power in the state Senate, which the Democrats still have, the Republicans controlling the state House, and Governor Hickenlooper? In a sense, to me, Colorado has been for a while sort of a microcosm of the national government. But now it's a little bit different, but not massively different, right? You still have the Dem executive, Democrat Senate, Republican House. I mean, what's your take on how things are going to proceed in Colorado politics over the next session?
You know, I look for the House Republicans to ultimately end up negotiating mostly with Governor Hickenlooper about the direction that we're going to go with regard to the budget. The big difference, of course, between the federal and state government is that we have to at least present a budget that appears to be balanced on paper, whereas they can do the $1.4 trillion worth of deficit spending if they want. Here in Colorado, we have a real problem. Our budget is out of balance with regard to expected expenditures, how much money the collective agencies expect to spend versus how much money we expect to have. About $1 billion, about 12% of that part of the state budget. And in the past, it has been balanced through a combination of accounting gimmicks and federal bailouts and a handful of tax and fee increases that have been passed without a vote of the people, of course, here with the Democrat legislature. I look for all of the tax and fee increases to go away, because I am positive that the Republicans in the House will say no to that. And I
will know, enough Democrat senators vote to eliminate them?
Oh, you're not going to roll anything back. Okay. I don't know. We need to take a look at that Amazon tax, and maybe they will be shamed enough to actually not want to have to vote on it again. But I mean, how things work, and that's why, you know, the U.S. Senate operates different. I mean, their rules are just different. They operate under unanimous consent with that filibuster rule at 60. So control of the chamber at 51 isn't as big of a deal as control of a chamber in Colorado is by one vote. At the House or the Senate in Colorado, if you don't want your colleagues, if you're the leader of the House or the Senate, and you don't want your colleagues, you know, your weak senators, your vulnerable senators, to have to vote on a piece of legislation that you don't, you know, that 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 might cost them the upcoming election, like a health care or something like that, or the repeal of the Amazon tax. You don't want to have to vote on it again. You send it to a small committee that's made up of three Democrats and two Republicans, and the three Democrats will be term limited or from very safe Democrat seats, and you'll tell them, kill that thing in that committee. And on the floor, we have no way to bring it back up like they do in the U.S. Senate, because we have a single subject rule here in Colorado, which, by the way, they should have at the federal level. And it's just it's a gone issue. So look
can't
for
the House vote on it,
you can pass the House and send it over to the Senate, and they will promptly send it to a committee where it will die, and it won't ever come out and be voted on by all of the vulnerable senators. Mm-hmm. And that's how things happen here. So anything that is substantial, that's what will happen with it. But then we still have to balance this budget, and you're going to have to negotiate with Governor Hickenlooper on how you balance the budget. And he has said that he doesn't have an appetite for new taxes and fees. I know the guys in the House on the Republican side aren't going to vote for new taxes and fees. So that's off the table. So what it's going to most likely come down to is a combination of a handful of cuts to some key areas, maybe roll back some of those Medicaid expansions, and probably trim a few other areas of the major parts of that general fund part of the budget, and then do a bunch of accounting gimmicks and probably rely on some more federal bailout dollars, which no one likes. But if you don't control both chambers to where you can actually cut the size of government, you're forced to play within the 40s and never ever move it down to the 10 or the 20 yard line. It is unfortunate, but that's what happens when you have effectively voted for gridlock.
Rich, you have
Greg, I think, one thing that I'm confused as just a citizen of Colorado is we always talk about we have to cut the budget. But I remember reading in the paper the other day that the proposed budget for the next fiscal year is $19.1 billion. Well, the budget for the last fiscal year was $18.2 billion, which, if I do my math correctly, means we're spending more money than the year before. But yet we're talking about budget cuts. So I know it's a gimmick and we're using a different definition of the word cut, but can you explain to the people at home, when we read all about cuts, that we're not really talking about spending less money than before?
Well, you have that quintessential reduction in the rate of growth of government that is often called a cut by government, but there actually were a handful of spending cuts that went through, but not much. Of the near $1 billion that was supposedly cut by the Democrat legislature and Governor Ritter, 82% of it was either federal bailout money or some sort of accounting gimmick, meaning that only $180 million was actually cut, as in spending reduced. A lot of that came out of higher ed. A little bit of it came from state employees and a 2.5% pay cut. And then those furlough days, which, they get six or something of those, basically turned almost every 3-day weekend into an unpaid 4-day weekend. And so that was an actual reduction in how much money was spent. And we also made them contribute 2.5% out of their salary into the para fund instead of having the states match at that level. So that was an actual cut. But yeah, 82% were some sort of accounting gimmick or federal bailout, which is why and then don't forget about the car tax, $250 million car tax increase, $800 million hospital bed tax increase. All of that is what led to the total size of the state budget getting bigger year over year.
Well, gentlemen, we've reached the end of this edition of Backbone Radio. Thank you very much, Rich Sokol, State Senator Greg Brophy, for being in studio with me and making this another great show. Love to have you again anytime you guys want. Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Ross.
So as we end this week's show, I would just like to offer a couple thoughts on the results of this election. Although I would call the election a modest failure in Colorado, given the results of the Senate race and what happened in the governor's race. Still, there are lessons to be learned from these races that I hope will serve us well in coming elections in 2012, when we vote for president, when we vote for state legislators again in 2012. And again, across the country, I would not look at the results of the Colorado race and let it make you feel bad about the direction of the country. Colorado has had its own special problems, its own special issues. hopefully Coloradans will be clever enough to figure them out and not make the same mistakes again. But in the meantime, we've elected something close to 65 new members of the House of Representatives. And keep in mind, these are basically Tea Party people with very little allegiance to the current leadership of Congress. And they are people who are going to stand up for liberty, low taxes, and limited government. And if there ever was any hope for the Republican Party to become what we have all wanted it to be for quite a long time before it lost its way so dramatically, this is the time for that optimism. I'm not a born optimist, but I'm feeling pretty good here. So anyway, thanks again for listening. And until next week on Backbone Radio, Ross Kaminsky.
KNUS Denver. This is the home.